Each new Sunday meant a brand new challenge, rich with new opportunities. A time for achievement, a time for purpose, a time for glory.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And this is our time together. I am live and lively here this day, this August 21st. Got to give you the date to make you confident that I'm actually in the studio today. Been gone for a couple of weeks, and my thanks to Brett Kunkel for sitting in for me here a couple weeks ago. We'll have him back for sure. But I'm here live and lively right here in the Marketplace of Ideas, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the open forum of talk radio. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. And note that, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150, because I'll have a guest my second hour here. That means this hour is the only time you and I have to talk together about some things that may have been on your mind over the last few weeks that I've been out of town. And so I want to encourage you to call in, since next week I also will be gone as well. So I want to give you prime time here for the hour that we have for open calls, this first hour of our show here on Stand to Reason. Again, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150, that's our local number. And just fresh back from our cruise in Alaska. Before I get to that, though, I have a very important announcement to make. Many of you know that we've done this video training tool. We call the kind of tool a Stand to Reason Interactive, in which you have a TV video presentation you could play for a group, and you go through a number of sessions. There's a workbook. There are interactive exercises. It's basically a plug-and-play thing. We did this with Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, and we're well on our way to completing our Stand to Reason Interactive series on tactics and defending the faith. All we have left to do, the workbook's done, the mentoring tapes are done. These are all available on CD. The only thing we have to do is to film the session, and I'd like to invite you to a free conference in which you could be part of the audience, where they film all six segments kind of back-to-back for the tactics in defending your faith. This will be on September 10th, just a few weeks away, from 8 in the morning until about 3 in the afternoon at Rolling Hills Covenant Church. That's kind of just on the north side, on the Rolling Hills Estate side of Torrance, here in the South Bay of Southern California. If you're anywhere within striking distance, call your friends, make it a date, come on down to Rolling Hills Covenant for a full day of a free seminar. September 10th, I'll be teaching the most extensive teaching that I've ever done on tactics in defending your faith, and this will be being filmed for production for the Stand to Reason Interactive on tactics. So I'd love to have you there. We'd love to have a full gallery. They can put hundreds and hundreds of people in this venue. It's a beautiful church, Rolling Hills Covenant Church in Rolling Hills Estates, right there near Torrance, California, not too far from the Torrance Airport. So make a date, September 10th. Be with me from 8 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. You can call Rolling Hills Community Church, Rolling Hills Covenant Church, rather, where we're having it, if you want more information on that. And that's area code 213-519-9406. That's 213-519-9406. Hope to see you there September 10th. Okay, now that's out of the way. Just kind of in the post-cruise blues, partly because having gotten back a week ago today in the evening, that's why I wasn't able to make the show last week, from our cruise, I've spent the last week, you know, kind of coming down from a sensational time on our Alaskan cruise with Stand to Reason. We had sensational people there. We had about 120 people or so that were part of our cruise. Of course, our speakers, J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, Craig Hayes, and myself. Great interaction, great training sessions, absolutely gorgeous scenery, and we had sunshine every single day. And this is a rarity. It for Alaska at least. It rained for 3 weeks up until our departure date, and right after we got back, it started raining again. But we had that one window of opportunity of sunshine all week long. I mean, you could see to the vanishing point, which was either on the ocean or beautiful mountain ranges all along the coast there of southern Alaska. So we just had a sensational time. And I know people wanted to go. We weren't able to make it because we ended up selling out basically the seats that we had available. But we're already planning our next trip, and that'll be coming up sometime next fall. And we are not going to Alaska again. Instead, we're going to the East Coast, and we are starting in Montreal and then going to up the St. Lawrence Seaway to Quebec, then to the Canadian Maritimes, which is, Prince Albert? I get the Edward and the Albert mixed up. They're on either coast. But anyway, just think of Anne of Green Gables, Prince Albert. Anne of Green Gables, that's where we're going. Then down to Maine, and then down the coast to disembark at Boston, all in the fall, late September. Fall foliage, friends. We'll be the leaf peepers on this wonderful cruise. We don't have the teachers squared away yet, but we do have... we're sketching out the plans, and that's what we'll do next year. So if you went on this cruise and you loved it, and or you missed it and you would like to go on our next one, keep in mind late September 06 to the Canadian Maritimes and the northeastern states, and we'll have a great time there too. So we'll tell you more as we develop more of the details about it. Let's see. I think I'm going to go to the calls. Prince Edward Island. Do I have time to go to the calls now? Prince Edward Islands. There's an Albert, but the Albert's on the other coast. I think we went by Prince Albert, right? Okay. So let's go right away to the calls. Kevin in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Kev.
Yes, hello.
Hello, sir.
Actually, I was calling, first-time caller.
Okay.
Show. Incredible stuff.
Thanks.
Always challenging, and that's why I listen. I was wanting to ask you a question. I'm an independent filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And freelance artist. I do a lot of various creative things, very right brain activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I was recently approached by a investor who wanted to invest in one of my projects, but this individual also invests in resort casinos.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally, based on knowing this person, having met him, and also my friend works for him, have discovered that this is a man of character. This isn't an individual who's out to, you know, to get people.
Mm-hmm.
But
in other words, he's the kind of person that you could rely on.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. He has integrity. He's also very humanitarian. He creates other endeavors that are humanitarian endeavors for the poor and things like that,
mm-hmm.
besides his monetary investments.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of the people involved in my project has brought it to my attention that they may have some issues with this, and they wanted to talk to me about it. And I haven't talked to them about it, but I've been doing some thinking and reading and research on how the Bible perceives, you know, gambling. And I don't necessarily have a problem with this gentleman investing in my project. However, I do have issues. I would have issues as, how would I put this? Someone who had made millions of dollars in abortions and abortions alone, taking that specific money and investing in my project.
Mm-hmm.
But gambling, I view it more, how should I put this? Although I'm not a gambler, I don't like gambling, I don't think it's a wise use of my time, I don't think it is necessarily the evil that many people portray it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think an addiction to it is bad. I think that's evil. And the ideology of getting something for nothing, I don't think the Bible supports that either.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm worried about making the right step. I want to make sure that I've thought of everything.
Okay, let me toss out a couple of things. I think this is the way you've characterized the issue here is somewhat complicated. That is that there are a lot of different factors here. One of them is the morality of gambling. Okay, that's one issue. Another one is, even if you answer the question about the morality of gambling, what is your moral relationship between someone who gambles and the investment of his money in your property, in your project, especially if this money was made through gambling? Does that somehow taint the money, and does that somehow taint your project or make you morally
culpable,
yeah, in participation, guilt by association or something. Mm. So I actually am not personally on the bandwagon about the gambling thing, the anti-gambling thing, per se. You know, I think that I guess I'm not willing to go overboard and say, you know, all gambling is inherently evil. I think that gambling can be taken to an extreme and cause or create evils. It can be pursued with evil motives. It can be pursued in maybe evil ways. But I don't know. I'm not convinced at all that gambling itself is immoral. I mean, that means if you're penny ante poker with the boys on Friday nights, that you're actually sinning when you do that. And it just isn't clear to me in the scriptures that that's the case, all right? There may be a downside to it. I mean, it might be that – I was just reading today in 1 Timothy, the last chapter, they were talking about people who are trying to be rich, and some people are trying to be rich by gambling. And Paul warns Timothy that people who really make it a life's goal to be rich are pierced with many a pang. You know, that was a clever way he put that. I said, yeah, that's right, you know. Now, he doesn't condemn being rich because later on in the chapter, he has directives that he gives to rich people. And that is to be gracious and not to depend on their money and things like that. But it's not having the money. This is where you have that passage that's oft misquoted, that the pursuit of wealth or the pursuit of money is the root of all sorts of evil, where it's misquoted to say that money is the root of all evil. That isn't what Paul is saying there. But there are liabilities there. So that's something that needs to be taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about gambling per se, the act itself, I'm not troubled by that, okay? So, I mean, my counsel to you would be, I wouldn't fuss too much about that issue. By the way, if you have a friend who this is a real big deal for and thinks that, you know, he does not want to participate in anything that has to do with anybody who gambles a lot, well, I think he's got to make that call himself. Paul talks about the person who, in a sense, contrary to fact, thinks it's wrong to eat meat sacrificed to idols. Now, Paul says it's not wrong, but if that person thinks it's wrong, then for that person to do what he thinks is wrong is injuring of his conscience, and therefore he shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes wrong for him. It's not wrong in itself. It's wrong because it injures the conscience, even though Paul is quick to acknowledge that the conscience at that point has been improperly informed. So I would say a properly informed conscience, from my perspective, wouldn't get all upset about gambling, wouldn't make this move. Even so, if he does, because he's ill-informed by my view, it's still his conscience that's in question, and he should not act in a way that violates his conscience.
Definitely.
Okay, so there's a little piece you can set aside and deal with that as you will there, as it applies to your circumstances. The broader question to me is, what is the relationship between that money and the harmful, if harmful, way that the money was gained that's given to you for this other project?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there's only two ways that this can be tainted money in fact. Now, I say in fact because it might be tainted in someone's mind, and we're back to the conscience issue, and my prior comments would apply to that. But is the money tainted in fact? Are you morally culpable or participating somehow in the way that this money was gained? You know, when the Nazis did all those terrible experiments on their on Jews to gain medical information, a lot of people thought, you know, we shouldn't use this. The information that they gained from this,
mm-hmm.
we shouldn't use this because of the way that the information was gained. Okay? They learned a lot about hypothermia because they froze a lot of people.
Oh.
Remember, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but yeah. Mengele and some of these other characters, these monsters, they did these things, but they did gain some medical information there. So what do we do with the information? And the field was split. Some people said the information itself is tainted by the way it was gained, and it's immoral to use that information. Others said, look, the information itself is benign, and at least if we're using it, it's morally benign, and if we use it, some good might come out of the bad that was originally associated with it. That was the position I took. And the reason I took that position, and I think you can see a parallel possibly setting up here, is because the only way that I think that it could be immoral for us to use that information, or maybe in the case of the money from gambling, if gambling were in fact morally suspect, is if our use of it somehow contributed to the immoral conduct. And this can be done in one of two ways. They're both slippery slopes, but they're very specific kinds of slippery slopes. One is called a logical slippery slope, and the other one is a causal slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
You with me?
Yes.
A logical slippery slope is when the thing that you're doing is so much like the thing that's immoral that there's a logical relationship to it so that the immorality slips over into what you're doing. Okay? Like some people say, murder is immoral, and capital punishment is so, in their mind, I don't buy this argument, but this is the way that it's working, in their mind, murder is so much like capital punishment that capital punishment, by logical similarity, is therefore morally suspect. Okay? That's an attempt to use a logical slippery slope. The other way is a causal slippery slope. Causal slippery slope is when the thing that you do actually, which it may be benign in itself, directly causes something that is immoral, and therefore your conduct then, in that it causes the immoral thing in a direct fashion and predictably, is also morally suspect. For example, I don't think doing research on cadavers is wrong. But if the research on the cadavers is infant cadavers that were gained from an abortion, and this creates a cash crop for abortion such that the continuing research encourages more abortions, then you can see how that particular kind of thing, because of the causal slippery slope relationship to abortion, becomes morally suspect. You with me on that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the question you have to ask yourself with the money that's coming from your friend is, do you have either kind of slippery slope relationship to that money? And to be pardon me?
I don't see either.
I don't see either. I don't see either, I guess I could say, to distinguish them. I'm with you on this. I don't think that there's a logical relationship to your use of the money and his use of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that that there is a causal slippery slope that's involved, such that if you make more of these projects, that's going to cause him to gamble more, presuming here for the sake of discussion that gambling is wrong, and do more of the wrong thing. I don't see either case. In fact, I think that would even apply to abortion money.
True.
In principle.
Yeah, I had initially viewed it, since this gentleman builds resort casinos and he makes money off of people gambling, I understand, like you were saying, gambling, the practice of gambling, depending on how, on the individual cases, can lead to evil, the addiction
right.
of it, etc. But I equated that in the same way to, say, a manufacturer of wine. Now, wine in and of itself, the drinking of it is not evil, and the actual thing itself is not evil.
Mm-hmm.
But to an alcoholic, it is a damaging thing. But
yeah.
You can't fault the manufacturer of the wine.
Yeah, would you take money from Gallo, for example, who want to invest in your enterprise? And listen, I would take money, I think, from an abortion clinic. If they got that money through killing babies and I can get that money and use it to good purpose for the kingdom,
and you're
to me that would be redemptive.
Exactly.
But see, I do think that there is a conscience issue there. I mean, some people just may be so personally
offended
by that, so troubled by that they just want to distance themselves from it. And I think in those cases, those people should. But now we're talking about a different moral principle. Now we're not talking about slippery slopes, either causal or logical. Now we're talking about conscience issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the principle here is don't violate your conscience. Even if your conscience is misinformed, don't violate the conscience. Don't injure the conscience.
Exactly. And the main purpose that I have gotten into filmmaking is to basically have an effect on society, much of what, like Hugh Hewitt wrote in But Not Up,
right, uh-huh.
wanting to have a positive effect on society. And through media, you can do that.
Sure.
That kind of effect. So.
Kev, I've got a break coming up here, so I have to go. But I've given you a couple of, kind of ways to think about this, and you can kind of put them together and see how they work for your situation, all right?
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Sure enough. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
That's Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason, and I will be back right after this. 1-800-227-5278 is the number, and lines are open.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-making and the will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And I am here live today, August 21st. Glad to be here, too. Gone the last 2 weeks. Coming up next hour, Professor Dave Horner from Talbot. We're going to be talking about a little bit more on the emergent church and the concept of truth and his take on it. He was a participant in the Emergent Church conference that they had, the conversation, a few months back, and I want to get his take on a couple of things. We've been kind of visiting this issue the last couple of months. 2 weeks ago, had an interview with Dan Kimball, and Brett Kunkel did that interview, and just trying to get our footing here. It's kind of hard sometimes with these folks in the Emergent Church because they're difficult to pin down. I've been reading some things lately, and it's they're always angry that they've been misrepresented, and it seems to me that if anybody's to blame for that, it's themselves, because they won't speak clearly on these things that are vitally important. But we'll be talking about that next hour with Dr. Dave Horner. And listen, coming up, and you might just make a note of this, November 17th, 18th, and 19th, on the East Coast, we're doing our big conference with the Evangelical Philosophical Society. It's called Reason for the Hope Within. This is where we have just about everybody who's anybody in the apologetics business meet together. They're all meeting for their annual EPS, Evangelical Philosophical Society, and ETS meeting, Evangelical Theological Society. So they're all in one spot. And this seminar, this conference, is the brainchild of William Lane Craig, who was former president of EPS, and said, look, as long as they're all here, let's have a conference every year in the revolving towns, or the towns where we rotate into. This year it will be in Harleysville, Pennsylvania, because the conference, the big conference, is going to be in Valley Forge, I guess. So very close to Valley Forge, we'll be having this at the Branch Creek Community Church. And what I'd like you to do is just right now, just check out the website, okay? You can go to www.reasonforthehopewithin. All right, just run it all together, reasonforthehopewithin.com, and you'll get all the information you need about all of the speakers and all of the conference details that coming up November 17th, 18th, and 19th. I'll actually be going out to Harleysville, Pennsylvania, on the 3rd and 4th of September to speak at that church as a way of kind of advance promotion of that event. But some of you will travel. Some of you will go to the ETS or EPS conference out there and want to stay for this event. Some will want to just go out to Pennsylvania in the fall just to be a part of this conference. So please go to that website and get the details and the information there. All right, back to the phones, and let's talk with – oh, I got another one? You want me to do them all right now? I got them. Okay. Okay, a couple more things coming up. Sunday, the 11th of September, right? Bel Air Presbyterian Church here in Southern California. Been there a number of times, but we haven't done anything with them for the last couple of years. So I'll be talking on the Essential Ambassador Skills at Sunday the 11th, and you can call them at 818-788-4100 if you want information there. Bel Air Pres in Bel Air, California, the 11th on Essential Ambassador Skills. And then Thursday on the 15th, I'll be at Rock Harbor Church in Costa Mesa at 7 p.m., and I'll be talking about relativism, feet firmly planted in midair. Apparently, they're starting a whole new apologetics emphasis there, and they've asked me to be a part of that program, so I'll be teaching there. Thursday the 15th, Rock Harbor Church in Costa Mesa. That number is 714, area code 384-0914. Did I get them all? For now, got it. Okay, now to the phones. And from Vancouver, Washington, Scott, welcome to the show. Hello, Scott.
Yes, hi, Greg.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. I appreciate your ministry very much.
Thanks.
I've been very blessed and working through the Ambassador Basic curriculum.
Good
and,
for you.
And loving it.
Good for you.
Hey, we had a guest speaker at our church last night who spoke, and I'll cut to the chase, on the parable of the talents and used, well, he didn't speak on that, but used that to essentially to talk about the importance of us investing our, you know, gifts and abilities for the sake of the kingdom and being good stewards of the same.
Uh-huh.
And he happened to make a comment, which is somewhat ancillary to my question, but the last verse, Matthew 25:30, that says, throw out the worthless slave into the outer darkness in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And he made the claim that, or he felt that that was not referring to hell, and that seemed odd to me. So it got me looking at the entire subject, and I've satisfied my own mind that in fact is talking about hell given the context of...
Well, where, I'm just curious, where does he think that is? It certainly isn't heaven.
Yeah, exactly. He was...
Or does he think it's just kind of a figure of speech that doesn't refer to any place?
Well, and he was kind of saying it's a place you're at when you're not when you're not a good steward, that it's just kind of like not comfortable. It's not, you know, like there's weeping because you're not a good steward, and you know, it's just kind of very schmarmy and.
Okay, do you have your Bible open in front of you?
I do.
This is all one discourse here. It's actually, as given by Matthew, the extension of the Olivet Discourse, which was the last major discourse, the last public discourse that Jesus gave, the Mount of Olives discourse, where he talks about the second coming and a whole bunch of things. And then Matthew has this long version here. In Matthew 25, he goes through and he's talking. What does it say in Matthew 25, verse 1?
Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins.
Okay, so he gives the parable of the 10 virgins, but he is using this parable as something to exemplify a truth of the kingdom. And then he continues to go on with more parables. So it seems to me what he is talking about here is the kingdom, not stewardship, in the sense that your friend is discussing it, the pastor or whatever. Do you follow me?
I do, exactly. I think his terminology was it's a kingdom principle. So he's a little bit confused on that.
Well, I mean... It may be that stewardship is a kingdom principle, but the first question is not – the first question when you deal with a text like this is what is it that Jesus himself is talking about? What is going on there? I mean, think of, for example, the Jesus walks on water, all right? And
right.
then Peter says, can I come out? And so he walks out and he sinks, and then Jesus pulls him up. Why did you doubt? And then he comes back to the boat. Okay, what's that about? You know, most people preach about that, and they'll say, well, these are about the troubles and the difficult troubles in life or the storms in life, and you have to step out in faith, and just as Peter did. And what they've done is they've used the account in the Gospels as their own kind of parable of a different point. They use it as an illustration of a different point, but that isn't the reason that John recorded that event there, because what is being taught there is something about Jesus' messianic office. And when he stills the storm, for example, they bowed down and worshipped him. This is evidence not of Jesus stilling the storms in our lives, but of Jesus as the incarnate Son of God who is to be worshipped. That's what's going on in John. And too often we go to these passages and we use them as illustrations of other points, okay?
Correct.
And I suspect that's what's going on here. here in Matthew 25, you have parables that are about the nature of the kingdom and the way the kingdom comes and the way the kingdom flourishes and the way the kingdom manifests itself, not about being a good steward with investing your money in the kingdom. It's about something else about stewardship here, but I don't think it's about what he was just describing. It's the kind of thing in which failed stewardship results in you being cast out into outer darkness where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. Now, you got to be pretty miserable to be wailing and gnashing your teeth. You're not just, gee, I missed out on an opportunity. Gosh, that bums me out. That's not wailing and gnashing of teeth. Wailing and gnashing of teeth is utter misery, and probably your own research has shown this to be true, Scott.
Correct. So I guess the question would be then, is it unfair or I realize that the passage is not intended to speak to the issue of stewardship as much as the fact that there is a judgment coming and that the righteous will inherit eternal life.
Well, it is a stewardship, but it's a stewardship of a different kind. The word stewardship is used here. It's an allegory of sorts, but it's not meant to teach the lesson, as far as I can tell, that the pastor or the speaker at your church was using it to teach. It was meant to teach another lesson, and what we ought not do is to take an allegory and let it be, or a parable, and make it mean something that Jesus did not intend it to mean. Can you imagine if I went to the parable of the sower, and I took those four different types of situations that Jesus described, you know, the rocky ground, the thorny ground, the good ground, whatever, and then I went and I applied these in an entirely different way than Jesus himself applied it when he explained that passage in the next chapter?
Right.
Well, I'd be misrepresenting Jesus. Yet it strikes me that this is the very same thing that's going on here. Jesus is not talking about how you use your gifts in the kingdom. He is talking about something else. Now, there may be passages that do teach on that, and if there are, we ought to go there and make our point, not abuse the passage where he's actually using stewardship to make a different point. Does that
Great.
Make sense?
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the call, Scott. I hope that helps out. And this is a common mistake that is so how can I put it? It's everywhere. It's pandemic, and I don't want to be too hard on pastors. I mean, they got a tough job as it is, but after all, what we want to do from the scriptures is not find our own metaphors for what we think are spiritually sound points. Like Jesus calms the sea, so this is about Jesus calming the seas in your life. No, the scripture there is not a metaphor for your story. The scripture there is given about an event that actually took place that is meant to teach something specific as offered by the writer, the gospel writer, in the sequence of events that he's describing. Why did John, for example, put that there, and why did he tell that story of what happened? Because he wanted to tell you something about Jesus. Not about the storms in your life. The Gospels are about Jesus, not about our lives. And what we're to take from those kinds of things is something about the nature and the power and the person, the authority and the office of Jesus, the incarnate Son of God, the Messiah. And that's where our work should be, and that's the applications that we should be making. And this is just another example of that same kind of thing, kind of getting too creative with the application, finding in it our meaning instead of the meaning that the author intended from the text. All right, back to the phones. A line open here, 1-800-227-5278. Let's talk with Rich. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hang on just a sec. There we go.
Okay, that's much better.
Yeah, I was on a headset.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't working too well. What's on your mind, Rich?
Well, okay, I've been having this running conversation with a friend of mine who takes kind of an Eastern viewpoint of life, and it's sometimes hard for me to know how to answer her. She's like, well, you're asking the wrong questions. You've got to look at – we're conditioned, and you've got to look at how we're conditioned to believe these things.
Uh-huh.
And goes on and on and on and on and on, and I'm just like – huh?
Yeah.
In many ways. I'm not that familiar with, besides with the Eastern, I know they have, and she's very adamant about what she believes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right, you know, and to me it just seems like it's kind of circular, because if I'm conditioned to believe.
Well, there's a problem. There's a lot of different ways that this sentiment, if I'm understanding correctly what you're telling me from your friend, is expressed. And Nietzsche said that all is perspective. Everything is perspective, you know. There is no kind of still point of truth anywhere. Everything is a person's perspective, and everybody's got different perspectives, so they have different ideas. There's a sense in which he's saying the same thing. We've all been conditioned to think a certain way, and that's our conditioning. And so she is kind of dismissing your point of view merely as conditioning. Now, I actually wrote about this in a ministry letter about 3 or 4 months ago. Do you get our bi-monthly ministry letters?
Yeah.
And Solid Ground? Okay.
I
made a point in that letter, and I can't remember exactly the illustration I was using, but the point was whenever you have somebody that you're talking about who focuses on the believer and not the belief, you know they are guilty of the genetic fallacy. Okay? You say, just for the sake of discussion, Jesus rose from the dead, and therefore he's Messiah. And here are the reasons why I think he actually rose from the dead, A, B, C, D. And she says, you've been conditioned to believe that.
Right. It never really happened. You've been conditioned.
Okay. Now, but notice how things shifted. What you've done is you've talked about an idea, a point of view, an understanding, what you consider to be a fact of history, and then you've given reasons why it's legitimate to think of it as a fact of history, and instead of addressing the thing, the argument, the point of view that you've just offered and the reasons there, she goes immediately to you and she focuses in on you and focuses in on your conditioning. Well, one way to know whether you've been conditioned is to show that your idea is completely idiotic and that the only way to explain you believing it is your prior conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't start with the conditioning. As Lewis puts it, first you have to show that a person is mistaken before it's meaningful to say why he is mistaken. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Your friend thinks you're wrong.
Yeah.
And then tells you why you're wrong.
Well, she tells me why I'm wrong, and she'll go into, well, it's mythology, and, you know, they had resurrection stories going all over the...
Oh, well, okay, now she's getting a little bit more substantial, okay?
Yeah.
Now she's going a little bit more to the reasons, which is the right place to go. Does it follow that because there are resurrection stories that are mythological, that nobody, therefore, could rise from the dead?
Right.
I mean, that doesn't follow. I mean, maybe there are mythological stories, and maybe there are true ones. You can't just simply dismiss the resurrection of Christ as a myth because there are other myths like it. You have to dismiss it on its own grounds. If you can show that the evidence in favor of the resurrection, for example, turns out not to be very good evidence at all, then you might ask yourself, gee, why would somebody believe this? Oh, I know, because he's conditioned to believe a myth. But this takes me right back to Lewis's remark. First, you got to show that a person is wrong. You can't just assume that he's wrong and then label his error as a myth that he's been conditioned to believe. You got to actually show it's a myth first. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
She's just assuming that it's a myth. By the way, if she thinks that all things are conditioned, everything's a matter of conditioning, I think it's fair to ask her from what kind of conditioning is she speaking as a result of?
Yeah. No, I ask her that, and I'm saying it's a circular argument. No, it's not. We're not conditioned totally. You can see somewhat clearly, and I think we need to see more clearly.
Well, that I think there's some truth to that. I mean, we are influenced by a lot of things that don't bear on the facts. We have ideas about things for sometimes the wrong reasons. Maybe we're conditioned a certain way. But the way to get past the bad reasons is to look at the ideas and see if they are right ideas in themselves. So if she says you believe Christianity because you've been conditioned that way, well, maybe you did or maybe you didn't, but that doesn't tell you anything about whether Christianity is true or false. You can be conditioned to believe a true thing or conditioned to be to believe a false thing.
But see, when I keep going, I go, okay, we'll go to the evidence, and she said, well, just because you have evidence that points to an ET doesn't mean you're any closer to having a relationship with an ET. You know what I mean? I said, what the evidence?
Well, wait a minute. Okay, hold on. I want to come back to this.
Okay.
Because I have something more to say, and we have a break right now. But you hold on for just a minute, Rick, and I'll follow up on the ET remark. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. You stay with us.
Are you searching for a practical overview of the Bible? One that will help you put into context the covenants of the Old Testament, the call of Abraham, and the history of the developing nation of Israel. Struggling to understand how Jesus fits into the picture and how the perfect fulfillment of these covenants and promises worked out? Greg's teaching called The Bible Fast Forward will help you see the big picture of the Bible. You will be guided through God's plan for man and its fulfillment in Jesus. You'll also gain a better understanding of history that will make your personal Bible study time more meaningful. Put the pieces together today by ordering Standard Reasons, The Bible Fast Forward with study notes and review software for your PC. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON. It's available on audio cassette and CD. That's called The Bible Fast Forward, available online or by phone.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel, back with you here. Stand to Reason is the show, ladies and gentlemen. I want to repeat my prior invitation. Where's that sheet? September 10th, coming up in about 3 weeks. A free conference from 8 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. I'll be the speaker. We're going to be filming it. We want you to come. It's at Rolling Hills Covenant Church in Rolling Hills Estates. That's just north of Torrance in the South Bay area. And I'm going to be doing a whole morning, early afternoon, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., teaching on tactics and defending the faith. It's for our new DVD set on the Stand to Reason Interactive Tactics Training Tool that we'll be making available next year. We got to do the filming for it, though, and we want a full gallery for that, so I want to extend an invitation for you to come out. We'd love to have 400, 500, or 600 people there. And you'll get a lot out of it. Won't cost you anything. We'll have a good time together. That's September 10th. From 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Rolling Hills Covenant Church. The phone number there, if you want more information how to get there, is area code 310-519-9406, 519-9406. Talking with Rick right now, who has been talking with another person about what he knows and what she knows, and she's claiming that you're all conditioned to believe what you're believed and wants to just dismiss your claims to Christianity, and then is somewhat dismissive of the evidential approach. And she says, if I understood correctly, just because when you were talking about evidence for Christianity, she said, if I understood your statement correctly, Rick, she said, just because you have evidence for an ET doesn't mean you can have a relationship with him. Is that right?
Right.
Well, go ahead.
Well, she said, you know, look, you want a tree. You can see a tree. You can go up. You can have a relationship with the tree, in a sense. But just because you have evidence of an ET you've never seen, you won't have one unless you actually see one, you know. And it's like, well,
keep in mind what you're doing here is you're talking about God.
Mm-hmm.
God's not an ET. He's an invisible being. So if, in fact, he does exist and you can have a relationship with him, of course it's not going to be a relationship of seeing and touching. He's not that kind of being.
Right.
So, I don't even know what all of her beliefs turn out to be, but I'm sure they entail the same kind of connection with certain things and dependence upon certain things that she can't see, touch, or feel or hear as well. They're not all given to empirical assessments. I'd encourage you to get a hold of either go to our website. Do we have the old ministry letters posted there, Melinda, on our website? This was about maybe in June. Oh, let's see, that's an even month. Yeah, June, I think, would be the ministry letter in which I talked about this. And maybe you'll get some more insight from that if you either resurrect your old copy or get it off the website. And I talk about the genetic fallacy there, and maybe that'll help you. I think part of what you have is you have a person who's all over the map.
Yeah, totally.
And it's very difficult to deal with people like that, Rick. You just kind of have to pin them down and slow them down and get them to make their statements and work with things one at a time and kind of cajole them into having this conversation with you. And if they're going to say, well, take off on a rabbit trail about myths or resurrection myths, I mean, maybe you can pursue one thing at a time, but a lot of times they don't want to listen. They just want to jabber. So you're going to have to make your own decisions about that.
That's true.
Yeah, there's no silver bullet there. There's no, like, here's the thing to use that'll really get them, you know.
Yeah, well, I was hoping to just, like, you know, have a nice little pebble. I could just, a nice little beep.
Well, yeah, there are some things that you could say that are in principle useful. It doesn't mean that it's going to make a difference to her. I would say stay in conversation with her and keep talking with her as long as you're able, and keep representing Christ to her and representing the truth to her in a gracious way, and keep loving her.
Yeah.
Just try to keep encouraging her not to speak nonsense here and to stick with the facts, as it were. All right?
Okay, thanks, Greg.
Yeah, appreciate the call, Rick. Let's go to, oh my gosh, Wheeling, Illinois. Deborah.
Hi, Greg.
Do you know that Wheeling, Illinois is a special place in my heart?
I do, only because I've called your show a couple of times.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, just for everybody else, I actually grew up in Chicago area, and Wheeling is one of the western suburbs, the northwest suburbs, and I grew up in part of my life at junior high period of my life in Prospect Heights and got bused to Wheeling, where I went to Jekyll and then junior high school, which I understand they closed for a long time. Now they reopened as a junior high school. Is that right?
Right. Jack London is open.
Yeah. And that was Wheeling. I left the year before Wheeling High School opened.
No kidding.
Yeah. So that was a long time ago, 1964, actually. So,
wow.
But anyway, what's up from Wheeling?
Well, I wanted to ask you to explain to me the doctrine of middle knowledge.
Okay. Middle knowledge is a term that refers to a kind of knowledge that God has. All right?
Okay.
And let's talk about three different kinds for the sake of our discussion here. One is God knows and believes all true propositions. That's kind of the very precise way of God's omniscience.
Okay.
He knows everything that actually is. All right?
Okay.
He also knows everything that could be, all possibilities. Okay, so, you know, if you were to shake up, you Scrabble things in a box or something, he knows every single possible combination. He knows every possible world that in the wildest imagination you can imagine, every possibility, he knows that too. So he knows all that is, and he knows that all that's possible. Those are two types of knowledge. Then he knows, according to the proponents of middle knowledge, then he also knows all the things. It's kind of a subset of the second thing. All the things that are possible given the contingencies of human freedom. All right, what they're called, one way of putting it, I'll give you the kind of philosophical way and then describe it, is the counterfactuals of human freedom. Now, do you know what a counterfactual is?
No.
That's something that might be but isn't. It might be that you called some other radio show instead of mine today, right?
Okay.
I mean, it might have been the case. You know, you could have done that, but you didn't.
Okay, I understand.
So instead of calling them, you called me. So you had the freedom to do that, but you did this. So calling that other station that you didn't call is a counterfactual, something that didn't happen,
okay,
of human freedom, your freedom. Okay? Middle knowledge is God's knowledge of all the counterfactuals of human freedom. Okay, now let's just take your case for just an example for a moment here. It could be that you had five different stations that you in principle could have called. Maybe you had two other stations that were Christian stations, and then there were and mine. So there are three Christian stations you could have called, and two that were, you know, in some foreign language, say Spanish. You don't speak Spanish, do you? Okay, so you had two other stations that were Spanish. Now, is it a possibility in the realm of broad possibility that you could have called a Spanish station? Well, yeah, it's possible. I mean, in terms of it's not impossible in any means, so it's a certain possible, but it's not a it's not feasible for you to do that because you don't speak Spanish. So there are only, even though there are five possibilities when you give kind of raw possibilities, there are only three that you might have been inclined to do call, and in fact you called this one. Okay? So you have five possible, but only three that, given your circumstance and your human personality, three that are in the running for you, two are counterfactual, one is a factual, you actually called me. Okay? So God's middle knowledge is like those three stations. Every single thing, let's just take you for example, Deborah, that you might choose to do but didn't do. Now, the range of things that you might choose to do but didn't do is smaller than all the range of possible things for you.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of, you know, raw possibilities that you would never choose in your wildest imagination. They're not on the table.
Okay.
So it's a smaller category. This is the category of middle knowledge. Now, by the way, does this make sense to you so far?
I can follow it, yes.
Okay, good. So I'll give you, maybe I'm making it more complicated than it needs to be, because in a sense it's a simple concept. David says in the Old Testament, he says, God, if I go up to these people over there and show myself to them, will they capture me and give me over to Saul? God says, if you go up, they will give you over. David says, okay, I'm not going to go up. I'm going to go somewhere else. So this then, that they would give him up, is a counterfactual because it never took place. But it is a counterfactual human freedom. It's that which would have happened if he had done those things.
Okay.
So God not only knows all the possibilities and all the actualities, but he knows all of those other things that you might have done given other circumstances, but having not been in those circumstances, you didn't do.
Okay.
Counterfactuals of human freedom. Now, once you get this middle category called middle knowledge in place, some theologians think and philosophers think you can do a lot of work with that. This helps explain, and Bill William Lane Craig has done a lot of work using these concepts of middle knowledge and toying with them and trying to tease out certain ramifications. If God does have this middle knowledge, then it can be used in principle possibly to solve some theological problems, maybe the problem with, you know, election and free will and a whole bunch of other things. Now, some people think that when you start talking about middle knowledge, you're talking about open theism, and this is a confusion because open theism actually, from a classical perspective, restricts what God knows, where middle knowledge advocates actually expands what God knows. Does that make sense?
It does.
So there's no threat of open theism kind of lurking in the background of middle knowledge advocates. Now, I will tell you, though, that all people who promote middle knowledge, as far as I can tell, are Arminians, not Calvinists. Calvinists have no use for that.
Next question. Okay.
They have no use for that, and some of them are fairly hostile to it. But for Arminians, it helps them to do some work that allows them to hang on to a very robust understanding of free will, which is what they're after, and yet at the same time, a strong understanding of God's sovereignty. Listen, if God knows in any one of two, he has two worlds to build, to create, and in one world you will freely choose to become a Christian, and in another world you will freely choose not to become a Christian, he can actualize the first world to get you into the kingdom, but not against your will, as opposed to actualizing the second world in which you aren't brought into the kingdom. There he's using his middle knowledge to elect you in a way that doesn't violate your freedom, or so the argument goes. Does that make sense?
It does.
I mean, it's kind of a clever concept. I actually don't hold to the view, at least the way that it's argued by William Lane Craig and others. I do think that there is a sense that God has middle knowledge, but I don't think that it does the work that they want to do. I don't think you can leverage middle knowledge to help explain these things about election, partly because I don't think that the biblical record when describing election and the like leaves open the use of middle knowledge to make sense of those concepts. I think there's something else that's going on there biblically, and therefore I'm not inclined to employ middle knowledge to solve these kinds of problems. But, you know, it's very interesting what they're doing. And I think in William Lane Craig's book, The Only Wise God, he talks more about that. Does he have that in there, Melinda, The Only Wise God? Does he talk about middle knowledge, Bill Craig? But you might go there. It's not a very thick book, but it's very interesting, very stimulating. So I'd recommend that.
God, that was the title, Greg?
The Only Wise God.
Okay.
William Lane Craig. All right?
Thank you very much.
Okay, Deborah, hold down the fort there in Wheeling, Illinois for me, all right?
I sure will.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now.
That's the end of hour number one. Dr. David Horner coming up hour number two. We're going to talk more about the emergent church and the issue of truth and just try to kind of, you know, wend our way through this mess that is brewing among Christians, talking about the integration of postmodernism with Christianity and trying to, from a missional perspective, trying to reach out to a postmodern culture and how do we hang on to truth in the biblical sense. We'll talk about that coming up next hour. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever.
You know, wend our way through this mess that is brewing among Christians, talking about the integration of postmodernism with Christianity and trying to, from a missional perspective, trying to reach out to a postmodern culture and how do we hang on to truth in the biblical sense. We'll talk about that coming up next hour. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason.
Have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
I'm Dr. Bill Meyer with the James Dobson Family Minute. Death is something that we don't like to discuss, but it's something we all have to deal with in life. Research shows that women tend to outlive men and therefore are more likely to be a widow at some point in their lives. Here's my colleague Dr. James Dobson with a thought about being mentally prepared.
80% of the women in this country will eventually be widows.
Right.
It is very important to prepare for that as best you can. You can never really completely understand what's coming, but you can certainly get your theological perspectives in line and begin to brace yourself,
right,
because it is part of life. You know, it is the human condition. It's everybody. It's all of us. The only thing that's different is the timing.
Death isn't something we should constantly worry about, but it's a topic to take soberly. It's a good reminder that we're all accountable to our Maker for our thoughts and actions here on Earth. We want to be prepared to meet Him when our time comes. For more on having a healthy perspective on life, go to family.org.
Next week on The Crawford Stand, the life and death of a television icon.
For years, Jennings was the festive voice of ABC News. Unfortunately, Mr. Jennings had little respect for that trusted voice, for he absolutely destroyed his throat and lungs by smoking. In his early teens, Jennings was already a fanatic smoker. One story had him using tea leaves wrapped up in toilet paper for the purpose of inhaling. Jennings smoked, by his own estimates, up to 3 packs of cigarettes daily for decades. Lung cancer is a horrible way to die. I only wish it were possible that Jennings could return to this life and do nothing but crusade against the killing harm of smoking. That message would be far more important to millions than anything else Peter Jennings ever said. Please don't smoke.
Next week on The Crawford Stand.
KBRT, Avalon.
Are you talking to me?
All right, hour number two, ladies and gentlemen, here on Stand to Reason. Talking about one of my favorite, the topic I love to hate, the emergent church. You know, I just don't know what to think about this anymore. I'm so frustrated with it. The more I read and I listen to these emergent guys, the more confused I seem to get and the more frustrated I get with them. You know, I want to be charitable and think the best of them, but I have a friend in the studio today that knows a little bit about some of the broader issues here and actually participated a couple of months ago in a conference over at Biola called Dave Conversations with the Emergent Church,
something like that.
Yeah, Dr. Dave Horner. who was one of my ethics professors over there at Talbot. You know, I only got two more classes to go, and I'm out of there.
Yeah, congratulations.
I mean, after 13 years, can you believe that?
Oh, you don't want to go too fast.
That's right.
You just lose it when it goes too fast.
Dave Horner's got a DPhil from Oxford and MPhil from Oxford and MA from Denver Seminary. He's teaching over at Talbot right now, and largely in the ethics area. I took, in fact, you did a show with me here on Aristotelian ethics, Eudaimonia, yeah. The good life, the whole thing, and that was really insightful. So, you tell me about the conference 3 or 4 months ago. What was the intention of it, and how did it unfold?
I think, well, I'm not sure about the intention, although I think we, some of the guys at Talbot really wanted to engage some of the guys in the emerging church movement and invited them to come and speak. And I was invited to speak because I teach in worship theology on the side. Mm-hmm. I've been a worship pastor and have a lot of views on these things. And they invited a major worship scholar, Robert Weber, to come.
Ancient Future Faith, right?
Ancient Future Faith.
Yeah, among others.
That's exactly right. And so they set it up as a kind of point-counterpoint kind of thing, mm-hmm. or a conversation between people in various areas.
Yeah, and they like the idea of conversation because they don't like debates. They're a little bit too modern for them, and it's too acrimonious probably in their mind, although guys like you are – a debate isn't a dirty word. It's a way you can kind of knock it around. And
I like conversations, too. But
Right. But so you have this conversation, get these guys together, and then there's an audience that comes, sits, and listens, and it's back and forth.
Yeah, and it was a sellout. I mean, they were sellout, perhaps. Well, I'll just
for
say.
For a free event.
Yeah, free event. That was very good. No, I think you had to pay for it. I'm not sure. Oh. But anyway.
Standing room only kind of thing, yeah.
That's what I mean by sellout, not the other notion of sellout, we'll have a conversation about whether it was a sellout in the other respect.
Well, yeah, that's right.
But in any case,
there's a little Freudian thing going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I don't know. There is. I think we better quit while we. That's why you have debates and not conversations.
That's right.
When you have conversations, this sort of thing comes out.
Uh huh. Okay.
The whole Freudian stuff. By the way, I just have to. As long as we're speaking of Freudian things,
okay.
I was at Viola the other day paying a bill. And the woman answering the phone had been answering the phone probably all day saying, hello, how may I help you? Will you go on hold, please?
Yeah.
And while I was standing there, I heard her say, hi, how can I hold you? And I said, so all the guys that call in, Freud would have a field day with that one. So. Okay, well, that has nothing to do with the emerging church, but
I think sometimes those guys want to be held too.
They might want
to come over to my jacuzzi and hold me, and we'll talk about our relationship or something.
So we had a number of those guys, and then a number of people from Talbot gave presentations. We all probably have, somewhat different takes on things.
J.P. Moreland, Gary DeWeese.
J.P. was not there.
Oh, okay.
Gary DeWeese, Scott Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking on everybody else, but we had
and others.
We had various people representing New Testament preaching and so on, and I was the worship guy.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons it was sold out, a lot of our staff was there. I was out of town, so I couldn't make it, is because we wanted to talk to these people that we'd been reading their blogs and reading their articles and reading their books and getting confused and frustrated and furious all at the same time because of what we were getting from these books. But then when you offer a critique – then they say, well, you don't understand us, you didn't get us right, and no, we're not that way. Well, then you ask for clarification, you get more mumbo-jumbo. And so this is an opportunity to have not really both sides square off, but at least to have a more public conversation where there can be a little bit of conversational accountability, so to speak, on some of these issues. So
sure. And some of that happened. There was a lot of more explanation, I think, on some of their parts. There were some backtracking on some of their parts, some assurances. One guy said, I'm not opposed to apologetics. I'm not opposed to all this kind of stuff. I just don't want to beat people up with it. But some of the things that he and others have written makes it sound like, they're opposed to
apologetics, or they view it as, of necessity, beating people up.
Right.
And that's the only way our kind of people use that kind of thing.
Sure. But there was also not a lot of, I mean, the conversation didn't go completely smoothly both ways. I would say that there was some real resistance, I have to say, on the part of the emerging church folks to what was presented. We had a couple of guys. Well, the first guy, a philosopher from Talbot, gave a pretty rigorous critique. And the response on the part of the emerging church guys was, why are you so angry? And one of the guys said, well, you know, people who are in the modernist paradigm put labels on on things, and so it's a matter of power and control.
See, this is the kind of thing that just chaps my pajamas, you know, when I hear this kind of thing. Because, first of all, it's an obvious attack on the person and not on the point that was being made.
Sure.
It's a dismissal as, oh, this is modernist language, and we don't do this. See, we're the nice people that don't get into fights, and we're not angry, but you guys are so angry.
Right. Well, also the move to say modernist people label people as a matter of power and control.
What do you call that?
That's, you know, if you've ever seen an example of labeling that's an exercise in power and control, that's it. And you don't have to have a conversation then. You don't have to deal with what someone has said. Is it true or is it false? Does it make sense? Does it strike home?
It's dismissal.
It's dismissal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say certainly not everybody did that sort of thing. That was the most egregious example of that.
Now, was the person who did that, in a sense, called on it during this conversation at all? And, I mean, that seems to me that would be an appropriate thing to say. Look at what you're doing here.
Well, it was a rushed conversation, and it was difficult to really follow through on a number of things. I actually responded partly to it, and I said labeling is unavoidable. You can't have a conversation without labeling, without seeing things falling under concepts.
Right.
You can't, and some, you know, labels are unavoidable. The question is only, is it accurate? Is it fair? Is it being used to marginalize or manipulate?
As
or,
their words were.
And in fact, emerging church is a label that is meant to be inclusive rather than exclusive. So, you know, labeling is a given. We just got to talk about how fair it is.
Is this part of the frustration that you guys are having with these guys, just that they are – I mean, just the response that was given there, it's difficult to pin these people down in what seems to be a legitimate way. In other words, they're talking about concepts. They're offering a critique of the church. I mean, there's no getting around that. They have some real objections with fundamentalism, at least the way they characterize it, evangelicalism as they understand it. Part of me wants to say, Dave, look, okay, you got a beef. Put it out there. Let's talk about it. Let's see what you got. And look, if we're guilty and we got to change things, let's do it. And the fact is they do put their finger on a number of things in certain circumstances. But then getting around to some of these other specifics, it just seems like they're beating around the bush a lot and toying with postmodern epistemology and views of things at the same time, which is what makes people like you and I concerned.
Sure.
There's a lot at stake. So what was your – let's take your presentation in particular.
Well, there are things that I want to affirm. And let me also, just to be clear, example that I gave you, as I said, was the most egregious one. And it really was the only really deeply unfair one. That said, I think the rest – the general conversation with the emerging church people needs a lot more – I mean, it fits the category that you're talking about. There's a lot of unclarity, and there's a lot of unwillingness, it seems, to really state things clearly and evaluate them, whether they're true or false. And it's frustrating. But I don't think there's, you know, in that one case, in most cases, there isn't the kind of just sheer marginalizing and labeling that, you know, and incoherence that there was in that. And I think just really kind of nastiness.
Yeah. Now let me just, on a side here, just to get clear on this, when this person made this comment, was it kind of with a smile on his face type thing? Or?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, in fact, he followed up later to make a more of a case for this, that the real issue here is power and control.
Mm-hmm. which is a classic postmodern kind of move here.
Sure, and that's what's frustrating about postmodernism, is it's the reduction of everything to matters of power and control. And again, it's incoherent, because if everything is a matter of power and control, so is that. But it's also not just incoherent, but it removes the whole conversation from ability to evaluate.
Right. There's nothing to talk about anymore.
Yeah, it's not a conversation anymore, really. I mean, the conversation, if we want a conversation, there has to be something that it's about and something that can evaluate what it's about. And that's removed. It's a monologue about power on each side.
Now, you started out in your own presentation talking about some of the things, as I understand it, talking about some of the things that you think that they had touched on that were legitimate concerns.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you...
Well, with respect to worship, well, actually, the way I started was to talk about a few attributes that I see trying to understand the post or the emerging church movement as a whole. And one of the things I came away with positively, I'll have to say, interject here, from the conference was an appreciation of the diversity that there is within this movement. And I think it goes all the way from on one end to really some places where it's mostly a matter of style, but no serious questions about truth and scripture, to, you know, quite a complete revisioning of reality on another extreme.
The postmodern extreme.
Yeah,
there.
The total buying into the whole postmodern, postmodern stuff.
I think Dan Kimball defines emergent church as any church that's trying to reach an emerging culture, which to me is hopelessly vague. I mean, this is, okay, we're all emergent then. I mean, if we're missional at all.
Sure. And but they're, you know, the folks that are kind of like Dan Kimball on perhaps on that end are, you know, they're doing some creative things to try to reach people. Some good, you know, great ideas.
He's conservative side.
Yeah, I would put him more on the one side.
Right.
And that's a very different animal from I'll just give you another quote from a publisher that I heard recently, who said when this whole thing started, we thought it was about a new way of doing church, but it's become a new way of doing theology. And the folks clear on the other end, it's a whole new way of doing everything. And there's some serious problems with that. And my take on it, my concern and what I was really hoping to do at the conference was to help people understand that if they want to reach people in an emerging culture and they recognize the weaknesses in many cases in evangelical churches and so on, it's not the case that their only alternative is that other extreme thing where you have to punt on truth, for example. And so I'm trying to build bridges. And so I wanted to affirm some real insights, I think, that many of these people have. I guess that's why I talked about the diversity, though. Because, you know, it's hard to make generalizations. But I think a couple of them would be, one is an ecclesiological sort of take that they have, a church, you know, their view of church that emphasizes community over individualism. And they see, and I think this is a proper characterization of a tendency in modernity to be individualistic. And so they're wanting more community.
Let me ask you a question, though. Even though it's a tendency of modernity, is it a tendency of evangelicalism to be wildly individualistic, or is there an emphasis on community there, too?
Well, Peter Drucker, the management guy, said to some pastors a few years ago, he said to them, you are the only hope for community in our culture. And I think we've got a lot more of it than perhaps anyone else. But I do think that there are those tendencies within evangelical Christianity. I think these guys are right, or people who are taking this, who are kind of making these observations, are right to say that we tend to think, we tend to even read the scriptures in a more individualistic way than, say, the first century Christians would have, or people in Latin America would, and so on. So we read Philippians 1:6, he who began a good work in you will continue to perfect it until the day of Christ. And we think, well, that's just me, you know, that's written, you know, when it was written to a church. I don't think it's I mean, I think it's appropriate to apply it to me, but it's secondary.
Right, right.
And when I've said that to people, they've gone, oh, man, I never occurred to me.
In other words, the work that God was doing in the local body, yeah. He will continue to perfect.
Sure, and it's
individual.
A plural.
Right.
In Greek, it's plural. And so it's, you know, Southern Greek is y'all. And, you know, that's just a revelation to most of us. That,
right.
Oh, okay.
Now, I do think that's characteristic of modernity, especially of evangelical Christians kind of coming out of that motif. I'm not convinced at all that what – I'd be very happy to be sure. corrected on this from your observations, but I'm not convinced at all that in that way that the emergent church are doing any better. You know, that they are really submitting their individual needs and natures and stuff to this community, and so it's community first and I'm second. I do believe there's a stronger emphasis on community, or a strong emphasis, but I think I can find that in a whole lot of churches before the emergent church came along.
Sure, sure. And in fact, that's one of the things I said in my presentation was that the main contrast between modernity and postmodernity, that you know, they put their charts up, and there's the modern church, and then there's the emerging church or the postmodern church. Is so unhelpful in most respects because every single thing that is supposed to be an attribute of the emerging church can be found in many cases in the last 500 years of the church. So you have the Brethren churches, for example, and all kinds of churches that were deeply, deeply communal. But having said that, it just seems to me, I mean, all of this, the generalizations are very, you know, They're very fuzzy and imprecise and vague, but there are some generalizations that seem to fit.
When we come back from talking with Dave Horner here from Biola or Talbot School of Theology, and just talking about the emergent church, his reflections and stuff. When we come back, Dave, I want to talk just a little bit more about some of these weaknesses in the church that they are reacting to, responding to, correcting, whatever, or at least they perceive themselves to be. And then some of your assessment on the other side, particularly from your perspective as a worship leader, since this is a very big part of community for the emergent church. And I want to hear what Weber had to say, too, on this issue, kind of as a counterpoint to the kinds of things that you're talking about. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-making and the will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Brett Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. My guest this hour, Dr. Dave Horner, and one of my professors in the past over at Talbot, talking about a conference on the emergent church that they had at Talbot a couple of months ago, and actually it was probably late spring now. I guess the time is drifting away, David.
Yeah.
And David made a presentation there, being someone who's done a lot of work in the area of worship himself and from a practical and philosophic perspective, and since community is such a, and worship is such a big part of the emergent church movement, had something to say in this kind of point-counterpoint type conversation. Was it Robert Weber?
Yes.
Yeah, Robert Weber was kind of matched, I don't want to say against you, but paired up with you. Let's put it that
right.
way. So we have this non-combative language here.
Right. And it was, and that's exactly the way it was. And in fact, we didn't know, we were encouraged to send each other what we were going to say, and we both were so late in putting together what we had to say that we just did our own things.
Uh-huh. Now, he's in print. I mean, he's written Ancient Future Faith and something about the New Evangelicals or something like that.
Yes.
He's done a number
yes.
of works. So he's been, and they're quite extensive works that he's done. And although I've heard some things about him that are alarming in terms of his views that lean much more on the postmodern epistemological side,
yes.
though he strikes me as somebody that's more conservative when you look at his work, but more so than, say, a Dan Kimball that we were talking about before. And so you talked about some of the diversity. Where do you think that Weber is coming from in his presentation? This is overall positioning in this whole discussion.
Well, he made the point. He said it's kind of funny that he is was included in this with all these young people because he's quite a bit older. As the ancient and future faith would suggest.
He's the ancient part.
He's the ancient part. That's right. He's hoping to have a future. And he didn't. He said probably after this they won't invite me again, so I have no future. But he wants to. He is where he fits here, I think. And I'm no expert on Robert Weber, but I have read some of his stuff, and it seems to me that the way he would fit here is as primarily a critic of modernity.
Mm-hmm.
He really goes after modernity, and what he sees in modernity is rationalism. Propositional truth. A lot of it's very epistemological
mm-hmm.
that he goes after. And
is he capable in this area of critiquing on those grounds? or asking a philosopher.
Right.
This is part of the problem, of course,
right.
when these guys
right. no,
get
I don't,
out
I don't,
of their ken, as it were, and start publishing.
Yeah. I disagree strongly with the way he understands the issues
mm-hmm.
and the way he understands the positions. I just think he's wrong. I'm not going to talk about whether or not he's capable of,
mm-hmm.
of anything. But his view is that the ancient folks, the early fathers of the church and so on, have the right view, and that they were very non-rational, or at least non-rationalistic,
mm-hmm.
non-propositional.
Well, give us
it was liturgy. It was mystery. And the whole thing of argument and evidence and that sort of thing is a modern thing.
Okay, non-rational, and you qualified non-rationalistic. Can you distinguish
right.
between those terms for our listeners?
I think that here's the way I would understand the way I'm using those terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the beefs that the emerging church people have and that Weber has. Is that current Christian practice is too, they would say rational. I think what they mean is rationalistic. There's kind of a thin rationalism.
Mm-hmm.
All we care about are propositions. Throwing out, if you believe the right propositions and you get your doctrine straight, that's all you need.
But this is kind of a grotesque straw man.
Oh, it's a terrible straw man. And apologetics and all this, the way they would do it is they think of it as a kind of fixation on propositions, a fixation on evidence, a fixation on argument, not really caring about people, not really engaging in personal spiritual formation and not having any room for mystery and all that kind of stuff. And so I would call that rationalism in a kind of thin sense
mm-hmm.
because there's nothing about that that really is opposed to rationality or being rational. It's a kind of caricature of it.
So rationality is using careful thinking to come to truth for the right reasons, and this has always been part of the history of the church. Rationalism is really more characteristic of the Enlightenment, where they elevated this to a godlike status without understanding our fallenness.
And
the liabilities that human beings have in using that.
And I think it's theologically suspect, but it's all rationalism. But it's also irrational. I mean, I think you can argue against that kind of thin rationalism on purely on rational grounds.
Right. So this is one of those cases where the terms are not made clear by these people who argue with these points.
And that's why I'm saying this is how I'm using these terms.
Right.
But I think that what Weber says, and then many people in the emerging conversation on their side, tend to talk about reason, rationality, propositions, and so on in this sort of way. It's really this thin rationalism that they're arguing against. And I think many of them think, and it seems that perhaps Weber thinks, that that's what it is. That's what a commitment to rationality is just that. And we have to get over that. We have to get back into the ancient views that we're not that way. Well, my field is an ancient medieval thought, and I just think he's got it wrong. Uh-huh. I think he's got it wrong. And I think to identify thin rationalism as a problem is that's right, but we have to identify it in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is not less reason and less truth. We need more.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be more rational. We need to think better. And so that's why I think it's one of the things that we have to say is that one of the huge problems with thin rationalism is this: it's irrational. Mm-hmm. It cannot sustain itself.
Mm-hmm. Can't be defended.
It can't be defended rationally.
As a sound perspective.
Sure.
This is why people say, well, Kokel, you're so rational, you're so logical. And I actually don't like that when people say that, because I think what they're identifying is, you know, what it sounds like is there's just a machine going on there. And I tell people, look, I'd rather not be thought of as rational, logical. I just like to be thought of somebody who's careful about the way I think about things.
Yeah.
Because I think when it comes to weighty moral issues and weighty theological issues and issues of truth, you know, you don't want to make mistakes here. And so you want to bring your best thinking to it. And so rationality properly construed is that kind of thing. I'm not making a God out of it. That's rationalism.
Yes.
But I want to employ it the way God had in mind. And, you know, we answered a blog, or we were assailed with a email or something recently that dealt with this thing where there was discussion coming from emerging church bloggers that the early church really wasn't interested in arguments. They were really interested in community. And I wondered, you know, where is this guy getting his information? Because all of the epistles entail arguments.
Sure.
The early church was persecuted because of things that they believed to be true, by the Jews because they thought Jesus was the Messiah, by the Romans because they wouldn't bow down to Roman gods. And so they drew the line in the sand and shed blood over propositions they believed they were true. Now, they weren't just propositions, for goodness sake.
Sure.
But they were truths or facts of reality that could be expressed in propositional form. They were dying for the truth, strictly speaking. And to pile insult onto injury here, all of the – now, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but look at the earliest writers, Justin Martyr and on. All of these early writers are writing apologies, defenses for Christians who are being persecuted, either that or theological defenses, in order to deal with that challenge that they're facing. So rather than the church not caring about arguments, it seems to me they were consumed with arguments, both public and private.
Sure, and to the death. I mean, they were dying for the formulations that they worked out carefully in the creeds and the councils of the church. I mean, these were the guys that did that. These are the guys that came up with these carefully worded, strenuously debated and worked out formulations of the truth. They didn't try to create truth by formulating things. Mm-hmm. They were trying to understand what they had been given, what mm-hmm. they had been confronted with, the truth of these matters. There were false teachings that had come in. They had to understand how to understand those and in relation to the truth and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wish... I mean, it's been said that the early church outthought, outlived, and outdied the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't do a very good job of any of those things, but certainly not outthinking it. And the solution to our problems, our very real problems in evangelical Christianity, is not going to be less reasonable, but more reasonable. We have to take truth more seriously.
You told a story a couple of times in my hearing. That's a favorite story of yours when you visited Auschwitz that I think bears on this discussion and why you care so much about these things and why I care so much about these things. Would you tell that story?
Sure. If you go to Auschwitz, you can visit various rooms that they have on display there. You can see the room full of combs. Piled from floor to ceiling with combs.
Hair combs.
And there's the room full of hair, human hair, that was shaved off the victims of Auschwitz. Most of the hair was actually sent to Germany to use to make blankets and sweaters for the war effort. You can go to the room that's filled with eyeglass
frames.
Right. And
shoes.
Yeah, all those different things. And then you can go to the room, of course, the showers where they were poisoned with Cyclone B gas, and you can go to the rooms full of ovens where their bodies were incinerated. To me, the most, and I visited there, I lived for 3 summers in Poland. It's in southern Poland. I lived for 3 summers there working behind the Iron Curtain in missionary work back in the late 70s and early 80s. And
I was there in 76, but just for 10 days, so I was in and out, but...
Well, the second time I was there, the woman who is now my wife, we were courting behind the Iron Curtain in Poland, of all things.
When there was an Iron Curtain. You know, you got to, for some people, you got to explain what
that is.
That's
right. There was an Iron
Curtain,
It was communist.
Yeah.
But the room that was the most disturbing to me, had the most impact on me, was the room that was full of suitcases. Filled from floor to ceiling with suitcases, and each one had a name painted on it. Little ones, big ones, that moms and dads and aunts and uncles and boys and girls and grandpas and grandmas brought everything they had and handed to some guy who said, "You can have this when you leave." Now, that second time I was there with Debbie, she pointed out that about right in the middle of the pile, about halfway up, or a third of the way up, was a suitcase, and on the top of it was painted Eva Horner. And I don't know if Eva was related to me, but just the thought that she could be made Auschwitz very personal. Now, what I want to say about that is that I know 2 things about Eva Horner. I know her name, and I know that she was the victim of an idea. Because Auschwitz was not some sort of absurd anomaly, a mystery. No one knows why this exists. It is much more accurately seen as a monument to an idea. It was an idea that didn't begin at Auschwitz, but an idea that captured the minds of German intellectuals clear back in the 20s. In German, it's lebensunwertes Leben, a life that is not worthy to be lived. And several hundred thousand people back in the 20s were taken out of nursing homes and in mental institutions and hospitals and put to death because it was determined that their life was not worth living. Ideas have consequences. What you believe will determine how you behave and ultimately who you become. And that's why I say, and thanks for the prompt on that, that's exactly why I say, what we need is not less thinking, less rationality, but better thinking, better rationality. Not thin, but rich, robust, fully biblical, thinking. Because ideas have consequences.
This is what kind of keeps me going in this situation, Dave, because I know the kinds of ideas that are being toyed with here in some ways by people who don't understand the significance of the they're playing with fire, I guess is what I want to say, and there are a lot of people that are picking up on this that don't know any better. I know a lot of young people being drawn to this movement, and they're drawn for sociological factors. They like the community, they like the worship, they like the emphasis on the poor, they like a lot of other things here, but in many cases these sociological aspects are being driven by a philosophical foundation that's poisonous to Christianity.
Well, it's also, there are theological aspects legitimate theological aspects, like the missional desire to reach people. And that's a good thing.
Right.
But what does that require?
To contextualize the gospel in a way that the new generation can understand it.
But then, for a lot of them, they assume that anything that's sort of trying to understand, you know, we try to understand the new generation, all that, so we start using the word postmodern and some of this kind of stuff, and then there's a drift or an assumption that this other stuff over here that's philosophical postmodern stuff must be related to that in some way or must be necessary in order to understand it. I'm not sure exactly how this shift occurs for a lot of people, and it might be much more sociological, but that's one of the things that I'm concerned about. And I want to say to these folks, you've got a great heart to reach people. You've got the right sort of instincts with respect to that. You don't have to go down this road. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go down that road, it's actually going to be worse because you're going to give up on having anything to say to folks that are dying without Jesus.
And I guess this distinction here is the distinction between, given an emerging culture, a largely postmodern culture, we can do one or two things. We can adapt our methods, which I think is probably what Paul had in mind when he said, I become all things to all men. And we always have to be vigilant in how we communicate that. Or we can adapt our message, since the world is changing. And I sat in ETS, David, and I listened to presentations given by evangelical theologian guys there that says we have to adapt our message. We are being left behind. We got to climb on board, or we're going to be left behind. And this was, of course, the issue that J.P. Moreland spoke so well to at his plenary address. But when we come back, I want to talk about the issue of truth, because this is something you gave some attention to in your presentation, and this is really at the heart of our discussion in terms of ideas have consequences. Greg Kolka with Dr. David Horner from Talbot Theological Seminary talking about postmodernism, the emergent church, Christianity, and how we all adjust to an emerging culture. I'll be back after these messages. Stay with us.
Are you searching for a practical overview of the Bible? One that will help you put into context the covenants of the Old Testament, the call of Abraham, and the history of the developing nation of Israel? Struggling to understand how Jesus fits into the picture and how the perfect fulfillment of these covenants and promises worked out? Greg's teaching called The Bible Fast Forward will help you see the big picture of the Bible. You will be guided through God's plan for man and its fulfillment in Jesus. You'll also gain a better understanding of history that will make your personal Bible study time more meaningful. Put the pieces together today by ordering Standard Reasons, The Bible Fast Forward with study notes and review software for your PC. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON. It's available on audio cassette and CD. That's called The Bible Fast Forward, available online or by phone.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kolkel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kolkel back at Standard Reason. Dave, you like the 60s stuff here?
I love it.
I'm locked into this.
I love it.
It's just, man, it's like.
You need some bluegrass, though.
Yeah. It's like as crazy as the 60s were, they just seem tame in a sense now to the way things are nowadays. I mean, it was radical because of the anti-war demonstrations, but I'm thinking from ideologically, in terms of the ideas that were promoted there were very dangerous, and many of them, however, now have taken root, and they become not just the avant-garde, it's been the average person believes what the avant-garde promoted back in the 60s. But in any event, Dr. David Horner is my my guest here for this hour. He's got his MPhil and DPhil from Oxford University, spent some time in Europe. I actually didn't know you'd spent so much time behind the Iron Curtain back in the late 70s. Is that right?
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s.
I was there in 1976, and I did like 5.5 weeks, and we did six communist countries. And but you were embedded there.
I was embedded.
Embedded there. We should have a conversation just about that. But the idea here that ideas have consequences, and the idea we're discussing here is the emergent church and the ideas they're toying with. And we've been careful, I think, you certainly have been, David, to point out that there's a range of thinking in the emergent church, and you experienced that even in the conference that you participated in at Biola / Talbot a couple of months ago in May. A lot of what you talked about when you gave your presentation there had to do with the issue of truth. And this is something that is one of those bugaboos with the emergent church, and something that, of course, guys like you and I are deeply concerned about. So tell us what you talked about.
Sure. Well, I actually didn't talk about it, but I wanted to talk about it. I ran out of time, but I talked to Melinda about it afterwards.
Oh, okay. So. Well, that counts.
Yeah. that's just as good as talking to the whole crowd about it. This relates really closely to what we've been talking about in terms of this idea of rationalism versus rational. Let me talk a bit about my understanding of a biblical notion of truth and how I think this relates to this. The core Hebrew term for truth is emet, and its core meaning, its original meaning, is stability or solidity. And it has a somewhat of a semantic range, but people like theologians like Roger Nicol have pointed out that there really are two main categories of terms that or ideas that come out of this word emet that are related, closely related, and inseparable really, but we use two different words primarily to translate this word: faithfulness and truth. And so emet is used to describe a person who is solid, faithful, dependable, loyal, that sort of thing. It's used to describe God that way. Mm-hmm. It's also used, obviously, to describe propositions and statements.
Ideas.
Speaking mm-hmm. the truth. And so on. And it's more than just being faithful in the way you speak, but it includes that. And you just can't separate these two things. And so you might say that one of those aspects really emphasizes the propositional aspect of truth. Mm-hmm. The other, the personal, being true, being authentic, being dependable, being faithful, that sort of thing. And I think that's a very rich way of thinking, of understanding what truth is all about. Now, what I think is going on here, largely with the emerging folks, and with let me just talk about postmodernism in general, is a loss that, and perhaps this is an Enlightenment thing, but truth had been kind of these two had been separated, and people think of truth in the sense of propositions, and then in the Enlightenment, thin rationalism mm-hmm. had thought you can't talk about truth and knowledge unless you're talking about absolute certainty, and it's just kind of rarefied, thin thing. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of the literature and some of the emerging church leaders, they pit the two against each other. Either you are a kind of a fan of propositions, you're enslaved to propositions, or you will follow Jesus in the community, following the story of Jesus in the community.
And this is where they make a big deal about Jesus is the truth. I am the way, the truth. So truth is not a proposition. Truth is a person.
Right. And truth, making all the proper distinctions, there's you know, a lot of truth to that. But it's not either or. It's not like being true is incompatible with telling the truth and knowing the truth. And in fact, a true person, a faithful person, is someone you can depend upon to tell the truth, to get it right. They're both things are there in Scripture. There's no possible way to interpret Scripture properly and see that the propositional element is not there. But it's more than that. For example, Jesus talks about doing the truth in John quite a bit. Telling the truth is part of that, but also doing the truth. Paul in Ephesians 4:15 actually coined a term a lot of people think. We translate it speaking the truth in love, but it's truthing. What he does is truthing. Yeah. It takes the noun truth and he turns it into a participle. Well, it's truthing in love. Well, obviously that means speaking the truth, but it also means living it. And so the biblical understanding of truth is a much richer notion than a kind of thin rationalism would say. And I think what's going on to a great extent is they're dissatisfied with the thin rationalism, the overly restrictive understanding of truth, and which is sometimes used as a weapon to beat people up or whatever, you know. They're tired of churches where people will sign on to certain propositions, but it makes no difference in the way they live and so on. And they are rightly repulsed by that. They're rightly dissatisfied with that. But then they think you have to reject propositions in order to go to some more personal notion when biblically they are both related and necessary together.
And in balance with each other.
In balance with each other. And so, once again, the Bible gets it exactly right. And to drop the propositional side in order to reject modernity is to fall into the very same trap, just on the other extreme. So what we need to do is to truth well. And that involves thinking well. It means, you know, wrestling with argument, being clear and so on, and living by what we believe, living it out, seeking to have integrity and faithfulness in the way we live our lives, that our communities would be characterized by truth and be authentic and all that kind of stuff. And the way I go with a lot of these folks, the interesting thing is postmodern people don't like truth, but they want authenticity. That's just a synonym. You know, authenticity is a kind of truth.
Well, they mean probably truth, excuse me, truth as we characterize the truth as correspondence. In other words, when your claim matches the way the world really is. And they're really troubled by that, and I'm not entirely sure why, because they use the term truth or some form of that in the sense of correspondence all the time. In fact, you can't avoid that. If you said truth wasn't correspondence, you'd have to come up with a different word to describe that kind of thing because we refer to that all the time. You know?
Sure. And when you're walking across the street, someone says there's a truck coming.
Yeah.
What you're interested in is whether that corresponds to reality.
That's right.
There's
no way around that. But they're very resistant to this. Now, and I'm not – this is where I start getting concerned. I'm all for though it's not, I would say, my main suit, you know, the spiritual formation side of things and the community, and I probably could do more with that. But what I'm concerned about is when there is the emphasis on that in a way that not just de-emphasizes the other, but denies the other.
Sure.
When the denial of that turns out to be the thing that is the engine that runs the Great Commission.
Sure.
It's Jesus is the Messiah, you know, he's the Savior. And so there seems to me to be kind of an implicit pluralism that begins seeping in, a kind of relativism with regards to religion. And you know me, my hackles go up whenever I strip out any kind of relativism, you know, especially on these important issues. So,
yeah.
But they don't seem to be concerned about that.
No, and I think part of it is, you know, just backing up for a second to what you said a little bit earlier, part of that is just, I think, this mistaken notion that if you don't think propositions in a kind of thin rationalism sort of thing, if you're opposed to that, then you have to buy this other stuff.
A false dichotomy.
Yeah, false dichotomy. And, of course, the literature is just riddled with false dichotomies. And so what we need to do is to help them to understand that this is a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And the biblical understanding of truth is much richer than this.
Do you think they're interested in that? I mean, on the one hand, I think that their sentiments are such that they're interested in it, but I don't actually see them responding well in those circumstances. And when people criticize them for these things, they immediately lash out, and I think in very uncharitable ways, at their critics. I have never, ever heard any EC person say that some critics got a good point about them. They always say, if you disagree with me, you're either mean or you don't understand me. Or else, if you weren't mean, you wouldn't be disagreeing. Or if you didn't misunderstand me, you wouldn't be disagreeing. And so it doesn't seem like they've got any stomach for genuine, charitable debate on the issues that they are speaking very confidently of.
I can't really comment on that because I haven't seen them in those settings that much.
What about this this whole issue of pluralism? Part of my concern is when you reject truth as correspondence, then when you say some things like Jesus is the way, not just the truth, but the way,
sure,
and all that that encompasses, this is part of the Great Commission. And it seems to me when I read McLaren and some others, they're very, very I'll give the most charitable characterization. They're very vague.
Sure.
On how this fits into this whole project. And they seem to be very unwilling to say that other people are mistaken about their religious views and instead just want to tell their own story.
Yes. And I think there's a very strong impulse to avoid offending people of other views. There's not the same reticence to avoid offending other Christians, you know, who disagree with them.
That seems to be the case.
But just, you know, kind of doing anything. So when Brian McLaren was asked about homosexuality, for example, I think he said, well, whatever I say is going to offend somebody and so I'm not going to say it.
I think that was in Time Magazine probably when they listed him as one of the 25 top evangelicals in the country.
And this issue of pluralism, exclusivism, inclusivism, that whole issue is obviously one of these hot buttons that nobody likes the Orthodox Christian view on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christians, a lot of Christians are kind of weaseling out
right,
on this
right.
thing.
Right, we've seen the same.
And so I haven't read this book other than to kind of skim through it, but Brian McLaren's latest book is A Denial of the Doctrine of Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the last word and the word after that, I think, is the title of that book. Is that right?
I can't remember.
Is that it? Melinda's nodding, yes. So
yeah, it just came out. It's a dialogue, or another one of these story things.
Right.
And, well, obviously, you know, who likes the doctrine of hell?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, one of those false dichotomies. I read an interview with Brian McLaren where he said, you know, a hell-focused gospel, you know, he's contrasting the hell-focused gospel versus, you know, the grace-filled, you know, life with Jesus sort of mm-hmm. thing. Again, who has a hell-focused gospel? You know, I don't know anybody who actually holds this kind of thing, but there's it's understandable, but I don't think it's justified, a reluctance to want to offend anyone mm-hmm. about anything, unless they're an evangelical critic of the evangelical or the emerging church.
Right, right. Well, I did a thing, you know, just on this topic of the hell gospel or whatever, and I went through the book of Acts and I looked at every preachment there in the book of Acts. 13 times the gospel is preached to groups or to individuals. And I was really stunned to see to find what I found, because there is not a single time where anybody is offered a relationship with God, not a single time where the love of God is mentioned. In fact, love is not in the whole book of Acts. Not one time is the word love even mentioned. But every single time, it's a stern warning. We are told to solemnly preach that there's a man who will judge the living and the dead, and this man, Jesus, God raised from the dead, et cetera, et cetera. The message is almost the same. Now, it doesn't have to be acrimonious and nasty and mean, but it is straightforward and honest about what's at stake.
Sure. And it's either true or false. Either it's heaven or it's hell.
That's right.
Either hell exists or it doesn't. And that's the truth issue.
That's it.
And ideas have consequences.
That's right. And so my concern then, if we're not willing to, if as Christians we're not willing, and I've been concerned about this for a long time, to be straightforward about the truth of the gospel in this regard, then there are a lot of people who are at peril for that. That's our music, Dave. We're all out of time.
Great music. Hey, it's great to be here.
Been a pleasure talking with you. And we'll have to do it again. But this is the kind of thing we can talk about for hours and still probably not figure it out. My guest, Dr. Dave Horner from Talbot Seminary, talking about the emerging church. And we'll probably be continuing this conversation for a long time on this program. That's all the time we have, friends. I will see you next time. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ, okay? Give them heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. So long, friends.